Thank you for that. Just two quick things about that. We're into thousands of hours now, not just hundreds by God's grace. But I want you, if you do do that, which you are not obliged in any way to do, but if you do go to graystoneconnect.org and you want to get on, use this code, Providence, the word Providence, all lowercase, to get a free month. That way you can just play around, explore, and see if this is really something you want to get into. And if you know a friend who would benefit from it, by all means, share the code with them as well to get a bit of access. I didn't see that coming, but thank you. Thank you, Blake, for that. Okay, friends, in our last session, what we want to do now is turn our attention to the more familiar passage on our topic, and that's the one found in Ephesians 5, verse 21 through chapter 6 and verse 9. And this time I'll read the passage for us rather than refer to it. Ephesians chapter 5 from verse 21 and to chapter 6 verse 9. The end of verse 21, or the end of the passage that ends with verse 21, reads, "Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ," which then sets up the ways in which this mutual submission plays out and what form it takes. Verse 22, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and blameless or without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Bondservants, or slaves, doulos is our word. Obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ, not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bondservant or is free. Masters, do the same to them and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him." Amen. I'm a father of four children, two daughters and two sons, which is very organized because they were two and then two in order. My wife is nothing if not very organized. And it's as though the Lord knew I needed to learn something and then relearn it again and then learn the other thing and then relearn that again in order to figure out what being a parent is supposed to look like. And as a father of daughters, and as a father of sons, as I know some of you in the room are as well, it has been quite an experience to explore what wisdom would look like in caring for them in the cultural conditions of their call to obey and serve the Lord and His people, and the conditions culturally of my call to care well for them as a father, and of course for my wife as her husband. And as I trust you can discern from what we have done already together last night and so far today, along the way, for a variety of providential reasons that are not only a matter of being a father, but also included being a pastor and being a friend and so on, and a professor in some respects, I have grown in my appreciation of the wonder, the marvel it is that God made woman, and how the more one might understand the mystery and beauty of this gift of God's creation, the more one understands as a result what it means to be a man in well-ordered relationship to a woman, but then also to man and woman to woman and so on. But as a father of sons, I will say that one of the challenges I have as a father is making sure that my sons know, in the world such as it is, that it is good to be a woman. It is also good to be a man, and unapologetically so. And it's most unfortunate that it's necessary at all for more my boys to hear that, yes, there are many awful men in the world. And yes, there are many awful husbands and fathers too. But that does not mean that it is bad to be a boy and bad to be a man. And it has been a source of continued sadness for me, frankly, although the Lord has spared my sons from wrestling with that in any serious way. To have pastored others and to have cared for others, boys at different stages of life, and young men particularly, who are quite clearly searching, even energetically, for some way of understanding what it would look like for being a man to be good. They are pounded, I don't think is too strong a word, you see, by a catechetical strategy of the world around us, which would pressure us to put men in the position of apologizing for their existence in some contexts, or to look at particular orbits of life and forms of activity that are characteristic of men as problematic, inherently so. Is there a way to bring alongside as lofty a vision as I have sketched already of what it means to be a woman? A lofty vision as well that is compelling, but not confused with the former, but that has to do with the dignity and value of being a man. And one which, in understanding it, in some ways also discloses even more of the wonder and beauty of what it is to be a woman. Paul thinks so, so I hope that we might hear some of the way he understands that for all of the world's confusion on such matters, the church as an outpost of a heavenly city and kingdom, as the expression on earth in the conditions of providence of the household and family of God, in the conditions of the world as it is, functions as a countercultural community along many lines, including these, that in the church, though the world may have a wildly different set of commitments and convictions, in the church it is to be expected we will see something of what it means gloriously to be a man or a woman. And that if there is any environment, any context at all in planet Earth and in human history where a young man and a young woman would learn the beauty, glory, and dignity of being exactly what they are as such, it needs to be, it would be, nothing less than the church, which is the habitation of the Spirit of God. And Ephesians 5 helps us appreciate the countercultural way in which this takes shape. In Ephesians 5 into chapter 6, we encounter what has long been a key passage in Christian discussions over family relationships, and particularly in the modern era, especially the question not entertained or explored very often before the modern era of whether women should in any respect submit to their husbands has been a driver for much of the discussion. This is a passage which is one of several examples we have in the New Testament of what Luther called in German a Hustafel, and which has been taken up as a term in New Testament studies ever since. Hustafel is household code. And as a household code, Luther is recognizing that what Paul is doing here, similar to what he does in Colossians, what Peter does in his epistle, is he seems to be reflecting a very established Greco-Roman convention of detailing the identities and roles of household participants, household occupants, in terms of what their ideal life should look like, what their roles, responsibilities are. Paul would, of course, have great familiarity with this genre of household code, and here he's giving us his version of a household code. And there's a lot of truth in that. But it's actually what Paul does in the contents of his household code that I have found, and I trust one or two of you might find, nothing short of revolutionary, not only in terms of the ancient context, which is its background in some respects, but frankly, revolutionary in terms of what I had long been taught to expect that this passage was doing, which it is not. Paul's concern here is undoubtedly to give a vision for the whole Christian family, yes, one which in its ordinary form includes wives and children, and in the ancient Greco-Roman as well as ancient Near Eastern household, slaves. The question of how to define that we'll leave to another conference. The structure of the whole family is in view, and there's an emphasis in Paul's teaching here on his matter of primary focus, which is to define one, and here's the surprising thing, I think, one particular member of the household. Now, conventionally, we read these words, I think, and at least some of us in the room will think, okay, this is Paul now giving, as it were, a set of discrete instructions or commands to the different parties or groups within a household as they are found within the church community. Especially significant because Ephesians is almost certainly originally a circular letter, not written only to the church in Ephesus. The ancient manuscripts, in fact, had a gap where we have the city name so that it can function as a circular letter. Go to Ephesus, go to Laodicea, go here, go there, add the name of the church, or the reader would insert the name of where he is at as he reads the letter to the gathered liturgical assembly. So that what Paul is saying here, he is not saying only because he's trying to fix a problem in one context, but because he's saying something that all Christians should believe, all Christians should embrace. So the argument that he's dealing only with a special set of unique problems when he uses this language falls away very quickly. This is universalizing language for Paul. It's simply what the church should look like. But then in this overall picture, we expect that he therefore goes from person to person in the household in order to say what each person needs to hear and remember. And in fact, while there is content addressing different members of the household, in fact, he has only one member of that household in view as his focus. And it is the figure traditionally known as the paterfamilias. The paterfamilias. The paterfamilias, who is at the same time in the conventional ancient household, who the one individual who is at the same time husband, father, and employer or master. Not three different people that are being addressed, or six different people that are being addressed. But one person is being addressed with implications for those connected to that person, but this one person in their three ordinary roles or contexts of life, is that one paterfamilial figure is being addressed in terms of those three relational contexts of privilege and responsibility. And it's not just the paterfamilias. It's the Christian one. The Christian one who, having come to Christ, is now about to learn the radical differences between being a Christian husband, father, and employer or master, and a Greco-Roman one, who's about to learn that the scope of the lordship of Christ in his life is indeed very, very far-reaching and of necessity transforms in remarkable ways even his conventional assumptions about his place and the nature of the exercise of his authority and powers. The husband, the father, the master of the ancient Christian family, with the upshot, as we will now want to discover by going through our passage, with the upshot that against the background of this context and knowing what Greco-Roman authors said about what it means to be a good husband, what it means to be a good Roman father, what it means to be a good Roman master, knowing the content of those other examples of household codes, we discover that Paul's theology of this figure and of the Christian home within the life of the church is nothing short of subversive, of conventional expectations about what it really means to be a man, and provides a substitute, not a polishing, cleaned up version, but an utter substitute, a replacement of what it really means to be a man as a Christian. And this subversive challenge is to the Greco-Roman model of the paterfamilias, which is in fact the origins of our language of patriarchy. Now, I know the word is now used in a variety of ways, but the origins of the word are in the Greco-Roman culture, where the patriarch within the Greco-Roman political sphere, particularly as households are extensions of a political figure's responsibilities and liberties, the patriarch was a man of unquestioned and unlimited power and authority, to whom everyone in that household is related as a subordinate and at the level at best of a child and then below that of a slave. He sits at the top of, as it were, of a domestic ladder and exercises his prerogative as a matter of largely unrivaled and unquestioned power, where there are manuals that explain how it would be undesirable but permissible, for example, for a paterfamilial patriarchal figure, even if he thought it necessary, to kill his servant, his slave, for disobedience, and among other things that we will notice as we work through the passage. Paul's vision of a Christian paterfamilias, who is not necessarily leaving his public position to do so, if he has one, but within the context of the church, is of a radically different sort. So we want to think about exactly how this looks in Paul's theology. The paterfamilial figure within the church is one who bears in his life and in his relationships the picture painted by the crucified Christ. The picture painted of a Savior who loves his bride sacrificially. This is a man who will love his wife in such a way, raise their children rather than outsource their care, and will even serve those whose vocation is to serve him. This is nothing less than a radical appeal to Christian men designed to catechize them in the ways of Christ precisely in terms of their ordinary spheres of life and of responsibility. It comes to us in this section of Paul's letter after Paul has singled out the special urgency of Christian patterns of life that renounce the patterns of life found that to dominate the Greco-Roman world. The urgency of living out the gospel that obtains for all men, women, and children, and which is rooted in the pattern laid down by Christ. The section, which begins generally with an appeal for unity in diversity and with diversity in chapter 4, verses 1 to 16, is followed by instructions on the well-ordered Christian life, which run all the way to the end of the passage. And it should not be dissociated from what Paul now says in a focused way about a Christian man. All believers, he has just said in verses 17 to 24, men, women, children, masters, and slaves should renounce false pagan ways of living, verses 17 to 24 of chapter 4. Renounce false attitudes and resultant actions, including lying, anger, theft, corrupt speech, bitterness, slander, malice, sexual immorality, impurity, crudity, covetousness, and generally living falsely. All believers should instead speak truthfully, provide for themselves honestly, speak in order to build others up, be kind, be tender-hearted, forgiving and loving, emulating God and Christ, all the way to chapter 5, verse 1. And before coming to the specifics of our passage, Paul therefore has already given the church a rich array of a profile for good Christian faithful living, which applies to men and women of all ages and all stages alike. And then he comes to the household code, which scholars generally recognize as an attempt to shield the new Christian movement from the suspicion among its pagan neighbors that it might undermine contemporary social structures and ultimately threaten the stability of the Roman Empire. At the same time, increasingly, scholars have recognized that it commends this positive vision of the church in a way that proves to be far more subversive even than the pagans thought it could be. And that the destabilization of the surrounding culture would not happen by way of uprisings and protests, but instead would happen by way of the Spirit having his way fundamentally and centrally in fully transformed men. Embedded in Paul's social vision is his utter and deep conviction that what has dawned in union with Jesus Christ is nothing less than a whole order of things, suffused with the Spirit, and which finds expression in properly reordered relations among those who make up the family and household of God. Which gives us now three parallel sections, each having two parts. Wives are addressed first, and then husbands. Children are addressed first, and then fathers. Slaves are addressed first, and then masters. Each section shifts to focus on what is effectively one person, the head male of the house, the paterfamilias. It is not the case, you'll notice even on a cursory glance at our passage, that wives and children and slaves are being addressed equally with husbands, fathers, and masters. Instead, even looking at how much attention each person is getting in these instructions, you notice how the man is being singled out for special attention. He's addressed in his singular identity three times and in different ways, whereas the wife is addressed only once, children are addressed only once, slaves addressed only once, and even when children are addressed and that's followed by a note on parents, it's not parents, it's the father who is addressed. Not the mother. What is going on here? The threefold structure with its climactic focus on the same person from a different relational angle suggests that the primary target of Paul's address is this one individual. And if we remember what he said back in chapter 5:18, Paul is telling this ancient man not to be drunk on wine, but to be filled with the Holy Spirit. An important clarification in the ancient Roman world, inasmuch as the ancient Roman man saw himself as quite free to indulge not only on wine and not only on women, but on many things without any curtailing of his liberties. He is, after all, the very pinnacle of the free human being, which is defined in ways eerily similar to the modern definition of freedom as the absence of constraints. Paul instead exhorts the man to live a Christ-shaped life, such as he's already described it for the church as a whole in chapter 4. But there's something else that is critically important to this picture to appreciate. We're told of what we're accessing here, what Paul tells wives, what Paul tells children, what Paul tells slaves. But in every one of these cases, although we can't go into the detail to demonstrate it, in every single case on the front side of our panel, let's imagine the panel, 3 and 3, who he addresses first, who he ends up addressing second in each case. In the wives, children, slaves column, in all three of those cases, when compared to what we have access to in the Greco-Roman world as the conventional expectation for women, for children, and slaves, Paul says nothing they didn't already know. And that would have been, by and large, fairly conventional. The exceptions come in when the wife's submission, her well-ordered, deferential relationship to her husband, is framed in terms of her union with Christ and her ultimate allegiance to Christ. As Paul would put elsewhere, she is submitting, but in the Lord, not because he is a man with limitless exercises of power. In fact, her being in the Lord defines the boundaries of what kind of deference she's allowed to render to him, what kind of submission would be appropriate or inappropriate. Her ultimate allegiance is to the Lord, not to him, and this determines the overall context and center of gravity for what that does and doesn't mean that she submits to him in the context of their harmonious relationship. With the exception of how Christ is contextualizing the kind of submission the wife is to render to her husband, Paul is only referring to what is already known about a wife's submission. What every Roman and Greco-Roman citizen would already say, well, of course we know this is what they do. This is what service they render. Children, obey your parents. Every Greco-Roman author and citizen would know this is what children are expected to do. The element that Paul adds is the fifth commandment context. You do this in the Lord. In fact, he addresses children in the lives of the congregations to whom this letter goes as covenant children because he tells them to obey in the Lord, as though he is assuming children of believing parents are already in a meaningful way within the Lord, in the Lord, and able to render obedience in the Lord, something baptism tells them is true from the outset. So he says something that everyone would say, obey children. But he puts it in Christian terms, render obedience to your parents as something the Lord strengthens and graces you to do. Obey them in the Lord. Here's the fifth commandment to remind you of the privileges and responsibilities of obedience to your parents. To slaves, he says, to render sincere, heartful service and obedience to their master. Again, completely conventional. No one is surprised. But Paul tells servants to obey their masters. But then when you look on the other panel, in all three cases, Paul tells the man something that would not only be utterly surprising for a Greco-Roman man to hear in his context, but which is subversive of those conventional expectations. Firstly, we learn that the man is to love his wife. A rather unexpected statement in the ancient world where injunctions to husbands to love one's wife are very, very rare. One author, Andrew Lincoln, who wrote a great commentary on Ephesians, notes that agape language is not found in Greco-Roman household codes. Another writer says, the exhortation to husbands to love their wives is unique. It is not found in the Old Testament, in rabbinic literature, or in the household codes of the Greco-Roman era. Paul is wanting to say something you don't often hear, and he's wanting to be very clear about it. Such a command is not found in any contemporary household code from the era. The husband's love is an agape love patterned, Paul says, on Christ's love for the church, a self-offering, self-giving love whereby Christ gave himself up for her, which recalls back in chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, where the whole Ephesian church, male, female, slave, free, Jew, Gentile, is to imitate God's mercy toward his children and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. So there's a cruciformity, there's a Christ pattern, which we find, of course, famously in Philippians chapter 2, 5 to 11, which is to mark and to distinguish the Christian man who loves his wife with a radical, conspicuous, strange in the eyes of his pagan neighbors, self-sacrificial service of total self-giving. Right after being told that wives submit to their husbands. It's as though Paul expects that the Christian marriage will look in this respect like it is glistening with the light of the triune life itself, inasmuch as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are in a perfected, harmonious fellowship of perpetual self-offering and love, but never lacking, who can give without losing, and always gain by their giving in the return they receive in the self-offering of the other, whose self-offering is never risky. As though Christian husbands and wives are freely able, on the one hand, to submit to her husband, and on his hand, to offer themselves as Christ does for the church to his wife, neither doing so with profound anxiety over what will happen if I actually do that. What will he do if, in fact, I assume such a disposition, such a mode of life? What will she do? Will she think me less powerful? Will she think me less strong if I live in a mode of perpetual self-offering and sacrifice that is not merely doting? We'll get to how she's not to be treated as a daughter or a son. That is not doting on an inferior, but sees in her my well-fitted other and knows I have no meaning or future apart from her in God's providence, and expects to find the fullness of my life by way of my fellowship with her rather than apart from it. And so my life takes on this mode of self-offering. That is not the Greco-Roman way. That is not the Greco-Roman way. We'll say more about this as the picture unpacks even further. In the second section, Paul gives that command to children. Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right, as we noted, referring to the fifth commandment. Paul, therefore, is granting children dignity. He's affirming their valued position. But it's remarkable that he addresses children at all. And then after this remarkable phenomenon of him addressing children directly and not doing so through the paterfamilias, not doing so through their father, which is the conventional and proper way of doing this in Greco-Roman society, you don't speak to children directly, you address their father, and then he deals with things as he needs to. After addressing children directly, he then shifts once again from language of parents only to the father. In fact, we get nothing about the mother here. It's as though he expects mothers will be motherly. But guys, we have to talk about what it means to be fatherly. Because you have been poorly catechized by your Greco-Roman context. He says to fathers only something that exposes something of the vulnerability a man has. Remember last night, line not circle. What are some of the vulnerabilities of being in this way? A who in a world of whats who needs to learn how to relate to whos as well as whats. Fathers, doesn't say this to mothers, not because mothers can never do this, but because there's something about this that fathers especially need to wrestle with. Do not exasperate your children. Do not exasperate, do not crush your children. Do not run over them in quest and pursuit of the good end you have for their lives. No matter what it costs to get there and what remains of them when they do get there. Instead of crushing and exasperating, of wearing them out, constant correction, never sure if they enjoy your affection, never sure if they enjoy your favor, correction at every turn. I used to pastor somebody who seemed always ready to offer a correction, not just to his children, but to others, and never gave it a second thought. This was his mode of life, and it was exasperating, and it was exhausting, and sometimes very difficult. And his children, for many years, grew up constantly having every little thing noticed, and there was no wisdom in learning that it's wisest and best sometimes to let a thing go. Do not exasperate your children, but that's not where he ends. But bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. This is itself remarkable. Why? Paul is painting a picture of what it means to be a male and a father against the background of the ancients. And what stands out, in addition to what we've noted, is his use of the Greek word technon. Technon. An inclusive term for children. A term that includes girls. Not the term huios, which is the word for a son. The father in the Greco-Roman world, you see, had responsibility for the nurture of the son in his household from age 7 to 16. Often he had the enlisted help of a pedagogue and a tutor to train his son from age 7 to 16. But here there's no mention of tutors, no mention of the pedagogue. In fact, the father is not outsourcing the education, training, the catechetical formation of his son to anyone, nor is he only catechizing, training, and educating his son, but he is also giving these benefits and services to a daughter, and he's not outsourcing either of these. He is himself personally involved with the nurture and admonition and instruction and care, the catechetical formation of sons and of daughters. No outsourcing. The father is here in view, helping personally to raise the children and to do so without making them angry and exasperated along the way. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of our Old Testament Hebrew scriptures, this very word for making them angry is often used for Israel provoking God to anger. The father, a Christian father, is to bring his children up without provocation. That's hard to do as a man over a long sustained period of time with children, sons and daughters, who are not always wonderfully responsive to the wonderful thing it is to be trained and formed and catechized by your parents and by your father. But fathers who are perhaps especially vulnerable to reaching their limits quickly or more quickly than a mother might, is being told here, number one, don't do it in an exasperating way. Your self-control, your self-restraint is the providential way in which God is graciously serving your children. And secondly, don't think you can outsource everything related to the children's care and upbringing to others. However much you deploy others, this does not mitigate your personal responsibilities directly and personally to invest in the lives of your sons and your daughters. Why daughters as well? Why daughters as well? Because it was frightfully common in the ancient world, as many have noted in a variety of ways and contexts, for especially humble Greco-Roman families who have limited resources, upon the birth of a daughter, to expose that daughter is the shorthand for it. That is to take the baby infant daughter out and leave her on the side of the road because she is not going to be a productive member of the household economy. She is just going to be a drag on resources. A drag on resources. One of the most remarkable pictures we have of the early church is of Christians who made it a habit of walking up and down these roads and collecting the daughters and providing for them. It was the Greco-Roman way to associate the male child with the potential for the economic security and productivity of that household, because this was a prospective politician, a prospective civic leader who would secure the welfare of our household from generation after generation. They're the ones you invest in, and you invest in them by securing the best tutor, the best pedagogue that you can, secure the best mentor to train them up to see if they might be the gleaming light in the family story and leave the legacy behind that secures financial prosperity for my family going forward. And when a daughter would be born, oh, it's like Henry VIII all over again. Not a daughter. This does not help me in my commitment to leaving a legacy, an heir, and so on. And Paul is telling Christian men, so far from not exposing your daughters, they, like your sons, enjoy your personal investment, your training, your instruction, your care, without exasperating them. daughters in the command to husbands are being dignified to a degree unprecedented in the ancient world simply by Paul's use of one word, techna. Then he addresses the slaves. The father and the husband, who is by now clearly one called to live in the gentle strength of Christ, in a mode of patience and forbearance, self-sacrificial, yet leading love, so that a wife feels and is in fact cherished, valued, honored, and benefiting from his service to her who herself submits to him, and who is a father to a child, a daughter and a son, who does not grow up broken and angry and disillusioned with the church because her father was awful and ran her away from him relationally, if not more so, is now also a man who is a master of slaves who are able to obey on the one hand with a well-ordered respect, reverence, in the sense, this being the sense of the fear Paul refers to, but without fear of their lives. In the Roman world, the empire was run on the back of these slaves, on the service of millions of them. This was normative. Their roles and situation varied widely. Some of them well-trained and afforded great responsibility, others treated horribly. And when slaves were poorly treated, some slaves would react against their masters to the point of rebellion and murder. While the command is shocking to our ears in a Western post-slavery context, just as in some ways people are troubled by the language of wives' submission to their husbands without the benefit of the larger picture Paul is painting, and of, you know, even of children obeying their parents, you can still see the ancients nodding in approval when it comes to that language, and especially this one. The direct address of the slaves, however, is again socially shocking and a mark of the dignity and respect that Paul gives them, which is not done in this era. But then as soon as Paul has spoken to them, again he turns to that man. The same person of the previous sections, the paterfamilias. And he tells them, shockingly, do exactly to them what you are wanting them to do to you. Stop making threats to them, knowing that he who is both their Lord and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. The appeal, do the same thing, is actually vague. It's not immediately clear what Paul has in mind. It could be their attitude to the Lord, or more likely, the perspective of Chrysostom or Chrysostom, that they are to have an attitude of service to their slaves and the Lord, treating the slaves not as vassals, not as possessions, but the way Christ treats humanity in bondage. Take on the attitude, Paul is saying, of Christ with respect to those he came to save, as he assumed the form of a servant in order to do so. The thought also arguably echoes what Paul says to Philemon, or Philemon. I did live in the UK for a number of years. To take his runaway slave Onesimus back, and to take him back no longer as a slave, but as above a slave, as a beloved brother, especially to me, says Paul, but how much more to you, Onesimus, both in the flesh and to Philemon, both in the flesh and in the Lord. In other words, while he may be a slave, the Christian will not see him as such. He is deliberately regarding him as above a slave. Such a status would be as a citizen, not of Rome, but of a heavenly city. This slave is therefore being elevated not to what Roman citizens desire and aspire to, but something infinitely grander. He's being made a citizen, or regarded as a citizen, of a heavenly city where no longer are there strangers and aliens, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, a holy temple in the Lord. And this one is to be regarded as a brother, says Paul to Philemon. And the appeal of Philemon 15:16, with here in Ephesians 6:9 being in some way connected, seems quite extraordinary, when it means that much of the ethics of what Paul is after is a matter of a man now entering into a mode of regard for others, of regard. So though the world sees them one way, the Christian will deliberately regard others in terms of Christ. And the way to do so is led by men who know and do this, who therefore set an example of, for their households, of the phenomenon of regard. In a wonderful book that she just recently published, Esther Meek, in this little book called The Mother's Smile, opens her book with a moving account. She's a Christian philosopher who used to teach for a long time at Geneva College in the Pittsburgh area, recently retired. In the opening section of this book, she goes through some detail through the phenomenon that is the very, very first experience we all have ordinarily when we come into the world from our mother's womb. And what is it? It is to be immediately placed in your mother's arms, and the first contact you have with the world outside that womb, the first experience you have, the first encounter with a person is the mother's gaze. And in the mother's gaze, it is, as it were, the child is being told, it will be okay. In this strange new world, you have a place. And the place you have is there in my gaze. You are the object of my love, the object of my interest, the object of my affection. Whereas the world, in an exposure, the child in an exposure situation, would for the rest of their lives be flailing about to find a place. In the gaze of the mother, they immediately are given one. And as the literature and research shows, when a child has this, including skin-on-skin contact for a minimum of an hour with that mother, it sets a trajectory for the rest of their lives. The lack of which sets a trajectory for the rest of their lives as well. That phenomenon of a mother's regard, Paul is saying, is a special blessing of what a godly man can do in his household, as what he is doing is he is deliberately resisting the catechetical formation of the world, and he is doing what our devices and what our tech culture and what our political culture tells us constantly not to do. We are not streamlining relationships, transactionally using each other as means to our desired end. And we are doing the very difficult but loving thing of eye to eye, face to face contact and relational friendships, and especially with our household members, we are looking with them and at them and regarding them. And the regard, which finds expression, is that I know you may be a slave, but I regard you as a brother in the Lord, as a fellow citizen of the household and family of God, of the heavenly city that will never fade away. And we are brothers in that family. I know you are my wife, and I'm so delighted at your glad submission. Let me offer myself to you as well. I know you are my child, and I know the world says that as a daughter you have no value. My regard dignifies you and establishes you have a place in this world. Among the most compelling, powerful things the Lord does for his people, he does through well-ordered, godly, wise men. And that is, he communicates to the otherwise wandering and lost, you have a place. And there are few things more beautiful or lovely, and yet which every last one of us wants, even pines for in this life, than home. And we associate, for very good reason, a mother's unique ability to cultivate not just a house, but a home. And Paul is saying, amen. And men, you too. With the regard you show, you have, as the man, a husband to his wife, a father to his child, an employer to his employees, the radically countercultural ways in which you show regard dignifies the other, enriches their lives, provides them the security of their relationship with you, and at the deepest inconceivable level, creates a home for people who are otherwise homeless. How can the Spirit work in the church in such a way that the stuff the world gets tied up in knots about, gender issues, becomes instead the very occasion for the church becoming ever more gloriously the countercultural reality on earth, an outpost of what could only be possible in the heavenlies as the Spirit has his way among us. It will not be by confusing what it means to be a man and a woman with a tussle over rights and justice. It will be by the happy submission to the wisdom of the Lord through his word, where we see an invitation tied up with our identity as man or woman to be the extension of home to others. And in a world of aliens and strangers, to be the place where God has made his name to rest and where he has established home, not least in the phenomenal gift of men who show regard. After all, is it not some of the beauty and glory of the gospel that the God-man himself looked upon us in our sorry estate and became a servant to elevate us from bondage to liberty, joined to himself a bride to wash and to cleanse her, and has put on display the character of a father who delights to give good gifts to his children? That's the gospel of God, and it is the God of the gospel. May he be praised for it.